Okay, Michael, first, thanks for agreeing to talk to me today.
Absolutely, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, I appreciate it. You know, one of the things I like about She Can Fly is that it really feels to me like a project. Like the book is really part of an overall project or movement. Is that a fair kind of assessment?
And the way we wanted to approach releasing the content when we were ready, and then after we've done so, kind of what we've built around it. It never really felt like pure memoir or pure nonfiction, or who was the author, who was the subject. You know, is it a book? Is it a resource? Is it a nonprofit? So it's kind of just been this, you know, work in progress since we started, and it's just sort of evolved as we went. And you know, we're really happy with where we ended up. As you know, it is a book, it is a memoir, it is a, you know, free resource, it is a website and a nonprofit. It's all these things, but at the root of it, it's just a really incredible story, and you know, one that we hope people can relate to and benefit from.
Yeah, can you tell me about this story?
So the story revolves around, you know, Carrie Keyes. She is the subject of the story. She is the nanny who raised me. That's how I came to know her. My parents, you know, were two doctors that had very busy lives and had trouble managing, you know, the home, and me, who was a, you know, kind of a carer of a 2-year-old only child, and they decided to bring in some outside help, a nanny, to work full time, taking care of me and taking care of the house. And they hired Carrie Keyes, and she came in, and you know, within weeks had our entire house running like clockwork. And had won me over, very quickly became, you know, my best friend. But she also taught me manners, taught me discipline, taught me how to cook and clean. And I followed her around and was your little, you know, buddy from the ages of 2 to 10.
Mm-hmm.
And at that age, you know, my parents were splitting up, and it was kind of a tough period for me. And Carrie was really my rock. And then one day she just didn't show up to work, and we didn't know why. And about a month later, we came to realize she had been arrested on a fugitive warrant from a different state and taken back to Colorado. We were in St. Louis at the time, where I grew up, where Carrie grew up. And, you know, we were floored, and we found out this is all because, you know, of a past relationship that was very abusive. And, you know, Carrie had been living, while she was working for us, she had living under a false name, no driver's license, no social security, no bank account, just flying completely under the radar. We paid her in cash, so she was able to kind of pull this lifestyle off. And, you know, she just kind of fell out of our lives for a while. And, you know, we sort of found out the details. It was a very difficult time for me because I was a confused little 10-year-old boy. And so it all kind of just didn't make sense for a really long time. But then Carrie eventually was exonerated of all her issues and came back to St. Louis and resumed her lifestyle of, you know, living in her little apartment and raising kids and taking care of people. And, you know, she always stayed in my life. It wasn't the same intensity, but, you know, our bond was so strong. She was my second mother that it could never really be broken. And I was in college, at Dartmouth College in 2008, and I was kind of on a destructive path of myself and, you know, not focusing on my academics and focusing more on my social education, and I ended up getting suspended from school. And when I came home, I didn't really know where to go, what to do, and so I just drove out to Carrie's apartment, the same little apartment where I used to build blanket forts and, you know, hang out with her on the weekends when my parents are getting divorced or needed some time off from me. And, you know, she cooked for me and let me cry on her shoulder and did all the things a mother would do. And then after I'd settled down, she just said, you know, some really terrible things have happened to me in the past. And I sort of nodded along because my parents had offered vague explanations back when it all happened in 1997 when I was 10 years old. And I knew domestic violence, and I knew prison, and I knew all these words that were way beyond the purview of my life, my worldview. And she just said, well, you know, I saw something today. I saw this woman being bullied in this parking lot. I knew exactly what was going on. I knew all the signs. It was so obvious that her husband was mistreating her and abusing her, and she had sunglasses on and these dark bruises around her eyes. And she said, I don't know, something clicked in me. I tried to help. I tried to get her into my car. I tried to call the police, and nothing worked. She was too trapped. She couldn't help herself. And, you know, when Carrie was going through this domestic violence situation in the 70s and 80s, there were no hotlines, there were no shelters, there was no resources. It wasn't even a crime. Mm. You know, the cops would show up and say, well, what'd you do to make him so mad? Like, we can take him to the bar, but he's going to come back and be drunk, and you don't want that. And she didn't realize why, if there are all these resources now, why is this still happening? Why are women not leaving these relationships? And that's exactly what it boils down to, is they're trapped. They're psychologically, emotionally, and physically trapped in these relationships. And if you can't see that it's not going to get better, if you can't keep and stop from telling yourself, oh, if I love him more, if maybe he'll change, maybe if he stops drinking, all these different things, none of that matters. It's never going to get better. It's just a slippery slope that continues until it devastates your life in an absolute way, like it did with Carrie. So she realized that the only real way to help, you know, women in situations like that was to share her story and to show the progression of an abusive relationship, so that women may have the foresight to get out before it gets too deep, because, you know, the longer you stay, the harder it becomes to leave until it's impossible. So hopefully by sharing her story, we can reach women at an early stage and, you know, try to give some sort of perspective on their own situations.
Wow. I mean, let's talk a little bit, Michael, about this societal notion that abuse is something that's easy for women to just, you know, remove themselves from. I mean, I don't happen to be one of those people that thinks it's as cut and dry as well. I mean, someone hits you once, you just walk away. I think that it's much more complicated than that for people. And I think that that's one of the reasons, you know, women get judged so harshly, because they're treated as these poor people that sort of deserve it if you're not willing to walk away. But can you just talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I think there's a big societal precedent of, you know, victim blaming it, seeing it all through the victim's perspective. And it's, oh, well, she must really love him, or she'd leave, she's getting what she's asking for, she throws out these bad boys, or, you know, she must be too stupid to leave. There's a million ways to blame the victim and excuse what they're doing. And, you know, they're making excuses up in their own heads and saying, you know, all these different reasons why they are staying. We have a dog together, we have kids together, we have a mortgage, I can't. You know, he still loves me, he's working on it, he's going to therapy. There's a million excuses that are victim-centric, but it's really all about the abuser. And an abusive mentality comes down to two things. It comes down to control and entitlement.
Mm-hmm.
For one reason or another, the man or the woman or whoever is doing the abusing thinks, I am entitled to control you because of X, Y, and Z. And the tactics that they use to exert that control, from emotional abuse, physical abuse, financial abuse, isolation, they can drag their partner's name through the mud, get them fired from their job, get their family to disown them, so they have them completely within their control, and that's what they want. And when you're on the outside looking in, you think, well, you know, it's easy to just walk away. You know, he slaps you once, I'll walk away, I'd never tolerate that. But there are all these other factors and all these other tactics that aren't just black eyes and bruises that are going on that prevent that from happening.
Mm.
And that's what people need to realize, is that it's so much more involved, and it's so much more insidious, and especially in the digital era, I mean, the arsenal of tactics that these abusers have at their control that are less obvious and much more subtle, it's unprecedented, and it's making it easier and easier to trap these women, to trap anyone, a victim in these situations. And that's why domestic violence is higher than it's ever been, which is so wild, because there are all these resources that have never existed before, and yet it keeps getting worse. So there's some sort of misconnection that's going on.
Mm. Wow. I mean, has it been your experience that you could that you can merely suggest to a woman that she's being abused and get kind of a, what do I want to say, not a favorable response, but get, you know, some kind of agreement from her? Do you know, because I asked that question wondering if there are times when a woman is in an abusive relationship but really doesn't identify it as such, do you know?
Yeah. I mean, in Carrie's own story, she says, you know, she just lost the ability to think for herself.
Mm-hmm.
So you begin to believe everything that the abuser is feeding to you, all the lies and all the manipulation. And you know, he says, well, if I didn't love you, I wouldn't take the time and energy to beat on you. You know, it hurts my hands. Look at my fists. They're bruised and they're bleeding because of what I had to do because you didn't listen. And, you know, once you get deep into this, you know, the mindset of a victim, you start to, you're like, oh, that makes sense. Like, he must love me. He must do it because, you know, he loves me and I need to do better. I need to work harder. So it's, you start to, you know, accept the treatment you're getting, and you start to blame yourself. So when someone says, you need to get away from him, he's treating you wrong, you say, oh, no, it's my fault, like, I deserve this.
Right.
So many words, you might say it's not abuse, it's just our relationship, we're working through some things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes it so dangerous, is because when that person isn't thinking for themselves, they're just complete, it's like a puppet.
Yeah, wow. Michael, how did you come up with the title, She Can Fly?
The title was, it was a long process. You know, we've been working on the main text of the book since 2008, so it's been, you know, 6 years in the making. And along the way, we had a few different working titles, and, you know, I'm an artist, so I'd always make up covers just to keep myself motivated and as a creative exercise. But when we finally got close to publishing it, decided we needed to nail down a title, and I was researching different titles of books and how people arrive at their titles, and I realized that Hemingway, most of his titles are from Bible verses.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was interesting because, you know, Carrie's religious, and a lot of what she went through came from her religious upbringing. And so I just started looking through the Bible for relevant quotes or topics or, you know, points that were made, and I was searching for, you know, suffering or pain or redemption or freedom or, you know, all these different ideas. And I came across a passage in Genesis about the birth of God, talking about how when this woman was impregnated with God, not Jesus, God, the evil forces of the devil were out to get her and corrupt that child. And an angel came down and gave the woman wings so that she might fly into the wilderness where she's protected for time and a half. And so I took that passage, so she might fly,
mm-hmm.
and kind of whittled it down, you know, analyzed each verb and what it meant, and, you know, took it from so she might fly to she can fly,
mm-hmm.
Because that's kind of the mission statement of the whole book. That's what we're trying to say, is no matter how deep you are, no matter what kind of situation you're in, if you just, you know, take the leap, you can fly.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where it came from.
Wow. So what do you, how do you see sort of the book evolving? Because it really does, for me, it feels like it has legs.
Yeah. So, I mean, we knew from the start that we wanted to offer this book free. We knew that, like, right off the bat. And that's one of the main reasons we decided to publish it ourselves and not go through a traditional publisher, because, you know, people in a dangerous situation, like a domestic violence situation, don't have a lot of access sometimes. Usually their finances are controlled, so, you know, their credit card statements are checked. What are you buying? What are you doing? Their internet may be controlled. What are you looking at? They can't have a book in their house that's about domestic violence because that's a threat to the abuser. So by offering it online completely free and in a pretty, you know, non-intrusive way, we knew we could reach the people who couldn't afford it or couldn't have access to the book, and, you know, otherwise. So that was, you know, a big thing for us. And then building the nonprofit around it to accept donations, which allows us to then donate, you know, keep the website running and offer that free version, but then also donate physical copies, the paperbacks, to shelters and centers of resource and schools all over the country, has been a big initiative of ours. So, you know, the majority of the proceeds from the book sales and from donations we receive go towards getting the book into places like that, where they can then pass it out to the people who come in asking for help. So that's been kind of the plan from the start, and that's going along really well. In terms of just generating more exposure, you know, obviously, you know, people read books and people go to the library and people research things, but, you know, what people really do is they go to the movies. So there's been some interest in a screenplay adaptation, which we're working on as well, just to kind of take it to a wider audience. That's been a big project of mine for the past couple of months. We're working with a school in Brooklyn to get the book onto their curriculum at a sort of inner city public high school that, you know, has a lot of kids who are in dangerous relationships. And to get the book through the, you know, the state approval system so it could be on their educational curriculum is going to be a huge move for us, we think. So those are, you know, getting into resources, getting into schools, and then just bringing it to a wider audience through exposure, whatever that means, is kind of where we're at right now.
Wow. Gosh.
We're just trying to share.
That's amazing. Do you have advice for someone who, like Carrie, observed abuse and just really felt passionately about trying to advocate somehow for the victim, or advice for people who, let's say, they a friend, or they suspect a friend or a family member is in an abusive relationship? What kinds of advice might you have for someone in that position who really wants to do something to make a difference? And, you know, it's very touchy, you know, it can be very touchy and dangerous even for, you know, for the person being abused and anyone maybe trying to get involved. Is there something that you would prescribe?
I think the best sort of tactics for helping someone in a situation like that is to one is just to listen. To, you know, if you see the signs, if you have an inclination that someone might be in an abusive relation, just remind them that you're there to listen, that you're willing to hear their story. And, you know, the last thing people, you know, victims want is to be told what to do, told, you need to do this, you need to do that, because they sort of, that's sort of the situation they're coming from, is being told what to do and being controlled. They might get twitchy at that. So just to listen, to hear their story, and just to be there is the number one thing you can do. Obviously, if the situation is, you know, you think their safety is being threatened, then that might be a time to involve the authorities and take it into a more formal manner of dealing with it. Because the authorities now, I mean, domestic violence, since the Violence Against Women Act of 1994, it is illegal. So if there's proof that, you know, a partner is being abused by their significant other, the authorities can take action. I know of, actually, my fiancé's father knew that one of his employees in his office was being abused. It was very obvious. Everyone knew. It'd been going on for a long time, and they eventually took action, and, you know, they set the woman up with one of their spare bedrooms and took legal recourse against the husband. And, you know, he lashed out. He threatened to, you know, kill everyone in the office, but at the end of the day, they broke the cycle, and the woman was able to rebuild her life free of his influence.
Wow.
But that's obviously an extreme example. You have to be very, very careful with how you handle something like that. But that is an example of how the system is working now.
Yeah.
And then the third way I'd say is, you know, if you are a victim who was able to leave an abusive relationship, the best possible thing you can do is just to share your story. Mm-hmm. To tell your story and hope that someone will relate with some piece of it and say, oh, that's, you know, that's how our relationship's starting off. You know, I thought I could just write it off as him being angry or stressed out, but like that, I understand how it starts like that, and I see where it could go, and I don't want that to happen. So just to have that sort of resonance and relatability is invaluable, I think.
Yeah. Wow. I think that the story and what you're doing with the story is really very impressive, and I hope that doesn't sound sort of condescending in any way. I'm just very moved by someone who would dedicate themselves to something that's so incredibly important in such a kind of a selfless way, you know, to make the book available to people, you know, to have the whole objective be to just get it in the hands of people who need to, you know, that kind of support. I think it's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it was never about making money. It was just about sharing. You know, Carrie's not a wealthy woman. She, you know, she still struggles to make her rent and pay her bills. And, you know, I'm kind of in the same boat. But we know that if, you know, if when we started this project, I promised Carrie we'd get one email from one woman saying, you know, your book helps me leave an abusive situation. And just knowing that, to have that sort of on the board is makes it all worthwhile. For Carrie, all the, you know, hours and dollars we've spent putting this book together and getting it out there, it makes it all worthwhile because what we're up against is staggering. I mean, the statistics are horrific. I mean, one woman is abused every 9 seconds in the United States, and three women a day are murdered by their significant others. It's just, it's like, why is this a problem of this decade? You know, this is like 2014. Why is this going on? And, you know, we're worried about the fat content in school lunches, and why is this not getting more attention?
Yeah.
So, just trying to get as much exposure to this issue and what you can do to help it is what we're all about. And I mean, it doesn't hurt that, you know, Carrie's story is one of the most, I mean, I've been involved with this story for the last 6 years, and I still think it's one of the more riveting and insane stories I've ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
So just to bring awareness to it through that that means is helpful, I think.
Indeed. Beyond donating to She Can Fly, how can people participate with you?
You know, as of now, besides donations, just sharing the word. You know, go on Facebook and, you know, share the page. Give us a Twitter shout out. Buy the book and give it to someone you think might, you know, benefit from reading it. Direct them to the website where they can read it for free. Just spreading the word is what we're all about right now. So that's all we ask, really, is just to share.
That's great. Oh, I'm happy to play a part in that.
Thank you. I appreciate
that process. Yeah, and Michael, tell me 100 years from now, what do you hope to be remembered for?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and I tried not to think about it too much since our discussion yesterday, but lately in my life, I've been trying to kind of figure out what my goal is and giving myself a sort of plan for the rest of my days. And I just want to be remembered for creating things that help people enjoy their own lives in a meaningful way. And I think that is the meaning I want to assign to my own life. And it sort of just fulfills itself in a circular way for the rest of time, hopefully.
It's incredible. Thank you. Thank you very much, Michael. I appreciate your time. Great story. Great effort.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be a part of your site and all the media you're putting out. It's all great stuff. It's really inspiring.
Thanks a lot. Okay.